Shrink Wrap Radio number 54, Understanding Autism, October 13th, 2006. Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio, the planet's premier psychology podcast. This is your host, Dr. Dave, coming to you from the San Francisco Bay Area. Shrink Wrap Radio is the show that speaks from the psychologist in me to the psychologist in you, whether you be amateur, student, or professional.
Now people talk about the autism spectrum, autism spectrum disorders, because there's a wide variety of conditions of certain kinds of impairments that are lumped under the label of autism. Basically, autism is seen as being a condition that has impairments in three different areas: in social interaction, in communication, verbal and nonverbal communication, and in imaginative play.
That was the voice of my longtime friend and Sonoma State University Psychology Department colleague, Dr. Lorna Catford. I first got to know Lorna quite a few years ago when she was working on a master's at Sonoma, and she took my class in Myth, Dream, and Symbol. In that class, she became very interested in the hero's journey. Later, after getting her PhD at Stanford University, she began co-teaching with Dr. Michael Ray, a very popular class on creativity in the Stanford Business School. During this period, she also wrote an excellent book applying the model of the hero's journey to everyday life and to the challenges of the business world. Some years back, Lorna returned to Sonoma State to become one of our most talented and energetic teachers. She is herself the mother of an autistic child, and out of that painful and challenging experience has created an award-winning program that trains and utilizes university undergraduates as in-home helpers for families dealing with autism. So without further ado, let's get into the interview. Okay, so I'm at Sonoma State University with my longtime colleague, Dr. Lorna Catford. So, Lorna, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thanks for inviting me, David.
Yeah, after all the different things that we've done together over the years, this is a new fun direction for us to take. And you've had a very diverse career teaching not only here at Sonoma State, but also at Stanford University, where you received your doctorate. So there are many things I'd like to interview you about, because I know you've been involved with a lot of very interesting stuff over the years. But today I think we're going to focus on your work on autism. And I know you've developed a program, but before you tell us about that program, let's start with some background info on the disorder itself. So first of all, how is autism defined these days? Back when I was a student, autism was sort of like just one thing. But I have the impression that that's changed.
Yeah, now people talk about the autism spectrum, mm-hmm. autism spectrum disorders, because there's a wide variety of conditions of certain kinds of impairments that are lumped under the label of autism. Basically, autism is seen as being a condition that has impairments in three different areas: in social interaction, mm-hmm. in communication, verbal and nonverbal communication, and in imaginative play. People with autism, of course, it's on a spectrum, so there's a range of severity. But oftentimes, a child or an adult with autism has difficulty interacting with people, responding the way people normally respond to social cues, often not picking up on emotional cues. Communication in some people with more severe autism, they have no verbal communication.
Okay. They miss facial cues as well?
Sometimes, yeah. Okay. Sometimes they don't even like to look at a person's face.
Yeah.
But, you know, they can communicate with noises and with movement. I mm-hmm. think you learn to read the communication of somebody who's nonverbal. And the impairments in imaginative play are that when children with autism, more severe autism, are given a toy, they often won't play with it in the same way that other children will. They might line toys up or get involved in spinning the wheels mm-hmm. of a car or wave it around. So there are some stereotyped behaviors that they might have. And autism actually, it ranges these days from very severe conditions that are included in the diagnostic manual, such as Rett syndrome in girls, childhood disintegrative disorder in boys, which I suspect with the revision of the diagnostic manual, those will not be considered autism, but they have autistic-like behaviors. So those are at the severe end, up through severe moderate autism, up to what some people call high-functioning autism, and then something called Asperger's syndrome.
Right, I was going to ask you about that, because I actually had contact with a ham radio operator when I was mm-hmm. back into ham radio, who let me know that he had Asperger's, and I was always trying to make him laugh and say funny things, and his response was always very flat and factual, very bright,
mm-hmm.
very technically adept.
Well, you know, it's interesting, because a lot of people with Asperger's get very angry that people think of Asperger's as a disability and say, don't cure us, we're not sick, we just think differently.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people with Asperger's are very bright, and they very often become very, very good at one particular thing that catches their interest. Often, you know, you described your colleague's flat affect.
Yeah, the ham radio operator guy.
Yeah. They often take things very seriously, very literally.
Mm-hmm.
So I could see why your joking around he might not have related to your joking around.
They also might, or at least in this particular guy's case, they might lack what would ordinarily pass for tact.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Being able to gauge somebody else's response, because I had sort of earned my black belt of ham radio, if you will, by becoming an extra class ham radio operator.
Mm-hmm.
There are 5 levels of licensing, and you have to know Morse code at 20 words a minute and a lot of technical information. And he was candid enough to tell me that I was the dumbest extra class operator he had ever met.
On the other hand, you can say that he didn't play social games.
Yeah.
He was very direct and honest, which I've found in a number of people with mm-hmm. autism and Asperger's mm-hmm. diagnoses. And of course, here I am describing a diagnosis, but every individual is so unique and so different that I want to give that caveat.
Sure. Yeah, that's always a problem, I guess, with all diagnoses,
yeah.
really. You know, a lot of people will have the image of Dustin Hoffman in Rain Man in their mind. How accurate a representation is that of autism in general?
I say that's very rare. Yes, there are people who don't communicate and are so fabulous at something that is astronomically amazing, but I don't think that's a really accurate representation.
That idiot savant kind
yeah.
of phenomenon
yeah.
Yeah, is pretty rare.
Yeah.
Okay, so what's the current view about the causes of autism? Or given the spectrum that you're talking about, maybe it doesn't even make sense to talk about causes, or at least maybe there are multiple causes or different causes for different syndromes. I don't know. You tell
me. Well, there's a huge debate about the causes.
Oh, goody.
Yeah. It's all very hot and heavy. The one I think that has the most heat is the notion that thimerosal, which is a mercury-based preservative in vaccinations, is a cause of autism.
Mm.
There have been studies, pro and con, many of each, some showing that when children have a vaccination with this agent in it, almost immediately they lose verbal skills, they start losing eye contact, start picking up stereotypic behaviors, and it can be traced almost to the day to when they got the shot. There have been epidemiological studies saying, yes, look, and showing correlations. There have been counter studies saying, no, there isn't a statistically significant correlation. There have been theories put forth that the causes are genetic. There's been searching for the mm-hmm. genes mm-hmm. that accompany a predisposition for autism. Heavy metals, that theory has been around for a while, and it's interesting that when Kanner identified the first, I've forgotten how many it was, 14 kids with autism and coined the term to describe severe autism. Most of those kids' families worked in the agriculture business, and a lot of the fertilizers had mercury and metals in them. So
now that would have been about what time?
1943.
Okay.
Or just before. I think 43, 44 is when he wrote his dissertation about these kids.
And that was the beginning of the use of the concept of autism?
Yeah.
And what vaccination are we talking about? Measles, mumps?
Measles, mumps, yeah. And, well, actually, it's even in flu shots. Now, and
I was going to inquire about those today.
Yeah. They're making thimerosal-free flu shots, and anyone who's concerned can ask for a thimerosal-free vaccination. I understand that those have been hung up. They're slow on getting those out to the market, but they're there. But there's other theories as well. There's recently some thought that older fathers may have a higher number of kids with autism. It's been linked to an immune system deficiency, perhaps allergies, different brain structures. I was reading this morning about some neurotransmitters being implicated. So I think there's still a search for the cause.
Yeah, maybe because it is a spectrum, maybe we're really looking at a variety of different disorders.
Well, I'm thinking it might be. Mm-hmm. One thing I want to say that is not considered a cause, and it was considered a cause when I was in my undergraduate studies, which is the notion of refrigerator mothers.
I knew that was going to come.
You knew I was going to say that. Right. Yeah, Bruno Bettelheim and even Kanner talked about very cold mothers being associated with autism. And the cure was to separate the kids from their families and give them intensive therapy.
Oh, gee.
Yeah. That idea is long since dead.
Good. I'm glad to hear it. Now, another one of the paradoxes, though, is that the statistics I've heard seem to be suggesting that autism is on the increase. And why would that be? Is it that the disorder is on the increase, or is it just that we recognize it better through new diagnostic techniques or the expansion of the category?
Well, you're hitting on a lot of these hot and heavy issues.
Oh, good.
One of them is the cause, and the other one is and the thimerosal in particular. The ideas about why it's on the increase. It is true that in 1994, the diagnostic manual, the psychological diagnostic manual, expanded the category for autism, the autism spectrum, and did include more items, and it became more in focus. And so there was a rise starting around or shortly after 1994. However, if you think about when you were a child or when I was a child, the number of children that we came across who had symptoms that looked like autism versus the number of children now, there really are more. And, you know, one of the questions is why. Some people say that the reason there's an increase is because children that previously would have been diagnosed with mental retardation or some sort of learning disabilities are now being labeled autistic. There might be some truth to that. However, the state of California, which probably leads the nation in documenting diagnoses, including autism, there are statistics from the Mind Institute in Sacramento and UC Davis that along with the rise in autism, the mental retardation rates have remained on the same almost level, just slightly rising projection. And if, in fact, children that previously were labeled mentally retarded were now being labeled autistic, you would see a drop in the mental retardation diagnoses accompanying the rise in autism, and we don't see that.
Interesting. Okay. Well, what sorts of treatment are available today for autistic people? I'm remembering years back, Dr. Lovas, I've forgotten his first name, Lovas.
Ivar
Lovas, that's right. He was kind of notorious years ago. He was at UCLA, maybe still is, but he had a rather radical behavioral approach in which he not only used M&Ms, but he put kids on an electrified grid, as I recall.
Well, today the Lovas method is quite humane. There's probably one of the main treatments is applied behavioral analysis, which has a lot of evidence suggesting that it works very well,
okay,
which is much more based on positive responses. You reward the child with hugs, maybe M&Ms, with tickling very often because they like it and it gives the social connection too. And you shape behavior and you teach children appropriate behaviors that way. In the school system, there's a lot of emphasis on wanting to use evidence-based strategies. There's ABA, there are some other behavioral ones, discrete trial.
What's ABA?
Oh, applied behavioral analysis.
Oh, thank you.
Discrete trial teaching, where you break what you're doing down into very specific steps and you keep data on what's happening and you respond to the specific small steps.
Okay.
And pivotal response training. However, what are also coming in, and the evidence is being gathered for these, are more socially oriented treatments and sensory integration techniques. Floor time involves, Stanley Greenspan's model of floor time involves playing with the kid. There's something that I've seen many parents use PECS, a picture exchange communication system, where nonverbal kids use pictures when they want things and they have them cataloged so they can get them, and a child wants a drink, instead of just making a noise or grabbing your hand and dragging you towards the refrigerator, would go and get the picture of the glass of lemonade or whatever it might be and take you to the refrigerator with it. So there are social approaches, there are visual approaches, making visual schedules so that the child can see what's coming up in the day, can help with dealing with transitions, because a lot of people with autism don't do well with transitions from one activity to the next. They need a lot of warning. They need to have a sense of what is going to happen when.
They're kind of stuck and attached to the routine that they're in.
Right. So they need to know, you know, what they're doing, when they'll know. They need to have a sense of what they're going to be doing, what's coming up, and also in any task they're doing, how will they know that it's over and it's time to move on, giving them nice warnings.
And I hear you saying that multiple sensory inputs are important too.
Yeah, with a lot
of auditory, but also visual.
Auditory, visual, tactile sometimes.
Okay.
With young children, this is where the occupational therapists come in. And also early intervention programs. There's a lot of tactile, of moving, swinging, which stimulates brain development and awareness of where the body is and is fun. A lot of physical approaches when the children are younger. There's another approach that I know many people find very useful, which is that of social stories, which is where stories are made up. When I get up in the morning, I walk through to Mommy and Daddy's room. Then I go into the bathroom and get my toothbrush. Then I put the toothpaste on the toothbrush and brush my teeth. Or you can make up a social story about getting on the school bus or going to the store, and you can illustrate it. And these are stories about how to behave.
Would you do it with, instead of saying I, would you use I, or would you say, would it be about the little bunny and the little bunny?
No, it wouldn't be about the little bunny.
It would not.
No, this is what we do when we go to the store. It's first person.
Because they'd be too concrete if you said
exactly.
The little bunny.
Exactly. Okay. Right, like your ham radio friend.
Right.
Yeah, then it's a story about a bunny. But if it's what we do, when we go to the store, we hold Mommy's hand as we walk down the toy aisle.
Okay, good. How long have you been interested in autism, and what was it that got you interested?
Well, I actually started working with kids with autism in a psychiatric hospital in Scotland in 1971. You may not know that.
No, I didn't know that.
And
That would have been before you and I met.
Yes, it was. And that was fascinating to me, and it was part of an internship that I was doing as part of my training. And then, 13 years ago, our second daughter was born. We were going to have the ideal family with two perfect kids, etc., etc. And then, out of left field, our daughter ended up being diagnosed with Rett syndrome, which is one of the autism plus diagnoses on the at the bad end of the spectrum.
Yeah, I knew she was severely disabled, but I didn't know that it fell within the autism spectrum.
Well, it does. Some people have diagnosed her with autism plus cerebral palsy plus epilepsy plus GI issues plus, but basically Rett syndrome covers that. Anyway, since our daughter was born, we became involved in the special needs community, started a support group for families of children with special needs, and I also became, totally unrelated to this, I became the internship supervisor at Sonoma State for the undergraduate psychology students. Well, in recent years, more and more parents would call me up and say, "Help, do you have a student who could do an internship working with my child with autism?" And there were so many of these that I thought, we really need to do something. And
so you started a program out of that.
Yeah.
Which I believe is called CATS, C-A-T-S. What does that stand for? And tell us about that program.
All right. It's the Collaborative Autism Training and Support Program. And it's a collaboration between North Bay Regional Center and Sonoma State University. North Bay Regional Center is a state agency, one of, I think, 21 in the state that provides services to individuals with autism and other developmental disabilities. And it's a two-year program. We got a two-year grant to fund a program that would provide students to work with children in their homes, children on the autism spectrum in
university
their
university students.
Yes.
Yeah.
It would provide university students to work with children with autism in their homes. The students would take a course training them to work with kids with autism. The parents would supervise the students fairly heavily at the beginning of the semester, easing off so the parents could have some respite towards the later part of the semester. Also, it's a true collaboration, not just between the regional center and the university, because the course is made up of probably a couple of dozen of experts on autism in the community who come in and give a series of seminars on the areas of their expertise. These are open to the students, they're open to the members of the community, and the parents.
The parents, right.
And the parents. And so it's just, you know, it takes a village to raise a kid. It takes a community to raise these kids. And I'm actually going to be writing up an outline of how to do it in case other communities are interested in coming up with their own community collaborations to support families of kids with autism.
Well, your program recently won an award, didn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, tell just briefly what... What was that award?
Oh, it was the best, the Outstanding Service Learning Program Award at Sonoma State University.
Okay, that's great. It does seem outstanding. And I looked at the list of speakers that you have coming in, and I was amazed that there were so many local experts who were knowledgeable about autism, about different aspects and facets.
Well, this is a fabulous community in terms of awareness and action towards supporting these people.
Right. So you've got all these university students then who you've got sort of working in the field, kind of placed with autistic or families that have some kind of autism going on. Are there any success stories that you can share with us?
I hear from families that they couldn't have made it without some of the students. I mean, one family in particular says that their student came in and communicated with their child in a way that no nannies, no tutors were able to do before. Another family has similarly said that the student that worked with their family, with their child, could connect with the child, communicate with the child in a way that was very meaningful and unusual. And in fact, both of these families, actually many of the families, have continued to hire the students on to work one-on-one with their children since that time.
Oh, that's a wonderful success. I wonder if maybe part of it isn't that the students are young themselves, they bring a lot of energy and optimism and hope to it, and they haven't become sort of jaded and discouraged.
I think that's true. And in the course, we very much want to get the message across that first of all, parents are experts. Secondly, it's a collaborative approach. It's a team. So it's not only is it the community teaching everybody about autism, but it's the student, the parent, the teachers, the therapist working together with the student. And in fact, in terms of the collaboration, the families both times wanted to put together a family network list so they could communicate with each other, set up play groups, share information. And also, one of the students that I'm thinking of that had some amazing successes with the child he was working with last semester is also now working with the county on their very intensive early intervention program. Another one is working with adults with autism. Several have gone on to decided they wanted to become physical therapists or occupational therapists. So what's interesting to me, as you said, that the students were young and alive, they get involved in working with these kids mm-hmm. and families. So, and that's what they want to do with their lives.
Yeah,
so
really your program's a win-win-win. It's a win for the parents, it's a win for the kids, and it's a win for the students.
Yeah.
And it's a win for Sonoma State University. It's a win for Dr. Lorna Catford. So that's great. You know, some number of people who listen to this program, and I don't know how large the number is, but I think some people are on career tracks where they're majoring in psychology, perhaps are planning to go on. Maybe you could give us a quick thumbnail sketch of what your progress was in terms of becoming a psychologist and doing this work.
Well, it wasn't a straight line.
It rarely is.
Let me preface it by saying I think there's two things that you need to be thinking about as you're looking towards building your career. One of them is three things. One of them is to go with your passion. What do you love and what are you good at? And go for that. Have some clear visions of what that is. You don't need to know what the specifics are, but you need to be aware of your passions and strengths. The second one is keep your eyes open for what's out there. What are some career paths that look interesting? Maybe interview people, maybe just see what's around that looks like it would call your name and find out about it. And the third one is be open to chance, to fate, to mm-hmm. the universe saying, come this way.
Mm. I like all three of those.
Yeah. So for me, I started out at University of Michigan. And
yay.
Yeah, you went
yeah.
there, didn't you?
That's where I got my PhD.
Yeah. Okay, I got my BA there. Very much interested in clinical psychology, consciousness, different ways of thinking. From there, I moved out to California and got my first master's degree, actually at Sonoma State University. And
I remember you from that
yeah,
period.
Yeah, you were my professor, these many years ago.
Yeah.
Gosh. Actually, I don't know if you remember this, in your class we had to do a final project, and I put together some music and slides of my artwork and me to represent the archetypal hero's journey. Do you remember that?
I think I do.
Yeah, okay.
Of course I do.
Putting you on the spot.
Of course
here.
I do.
But that was very important to me. I think I was interested. I've been interested in...
Well, you went on to write a book about the hero's
yeah.
journey, actually.
Yeah. It's called The Path of the Everyday Hero, Drawing on the Power of Myth to Meet Life's Most Important Challenges. And it takes the notion of the hero's journey that we all are called to adventure at certain times in our lives, leap into the abyss, into the bottomless pit of, oh my goodness, how am I going to solve this? And through luck, through strength, through perseverance, through meeting allies, we solve it and we emerge richer and deeper and with something to contribute.
And I highly recommend the book. And now you said you got your first master's at Sonoma State. Was there another one?
Oh, then I went to Stanford, and I got a master's and a PhD. Well, I was interested in different thinking styles, once again, and I got involved in documenting how people making decisions in business don't just use analytical strategies, but they use emotional ones and intuitive ones and physical ones as well. And my book, in fact, is based on that work at Stanford with my partner, Michael Ray, and has a lot of ideas for using those all those strategies for dealing with life's problems. And the joke is that the book was too long, and the publisher said, well, you know, you have to stop writing somewhere. And one of the chapters that didn't get put in the book was dealing with health issues. I mean, a lot of other issues relating to having kids with autism, but the one in health issues was taken out. And then my second daughter was born, almost as a way of saying, oh, you left this out of the book, well, here.
Oh, my goodness. My goodness. Is there a book that you'd recommend on the topic of autism?
Actually, there are a couple that I use in my course. One of them is just called Autism Spectrum Disorders by a parent called Chantal Sicily-Kira, I believe. Sicily-Kira. Very easy to read, good overview. And then in my course, I use that plus another book, a new book out, 2006 by Pearson, called Students with Autism Spectrum Disorders by L.J. Heflin and D.F. Alaimo, A-L-A-I-M-O.
Okay, well, thank you for that detailed breakdown on those book titles, and I want to thank you so much for being my guest here today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you, David. It was wonderful to talk with you.
I hope you found this conversation with Dr. Lorna Catford instructive. I know I did. One of the things that stands out for me from our discussion is her comment about an earlier theory of autism which identified a cold, rejecting mother as the cause of autism. The term she used, refrigerator mother, is one that actually occurs in the autism literature, at least the literature from some time back. Rejecting mothers and distant dads have long been the usual suspects for a wide array of psychological problems. I'm sure there are situations where that assessment is justified. The other side of the coin, though, is to consider whether these parental attitudes are the cause of the problem or the effect of the problem. Autistic children, for example, can be extremely demanding, draining, and unresponsive to mothering. In the absence of the positive feedback loop between mother and child, it's easy to understand how some mothers might burn out. In our conversation, Dr. Catford referred to both Leo Kanner, who first coined the term autism, and Bruno Bettelheim, an influential psychoanalytic writer. I have to say that Bruno Bettelheim was required reading in my own graduate training, and he wrote several popular books that were read by lay people across the land. Throughout the years I was in graduate school, I supported myself in part by teaching sections of Introduction to Psychology at both the University of Montana, where I received my master's, and later at the University of Michigan, where I completed my doctoral studies. I don't have any specific memory of teaching the refrigerator mother theory to my students, but given the time and the psychoanalytic orientation of the Michigan Psychology Department, I think it's very likely that I did. In relation to schizophrenia, there was a somewhat similar concept going on at the time, and the term used there was the schizophrenogenic mother. This theory states that mothers of schizophrenic individuals tend to be cold, rejecting, and yet controlling. As far as I know, this idea was first developed by Frieda von Reichman, another very influential psychoanalyst, and an author of several popular books as well. The idea was further promoted by Gregory Bateson, working with Jackson and Virginia Satir in the development of family therapy. Well, I do recall passing this theory along to students back when I was in graduate school. So I'm afraid mothers have taken a bad rap historically in psychology and psychiatry. In both autism and schizophrenia, it's now understood that the causes are far more complex than bad parenting. Current theories are much more likely to emphasize neurological deficits. When the therapists go in to study the families of autistic or schizophrenic individuals, they may indeed discover weird communication patterns. But as I said earlier, those dynamics may be an effect of dealing with a disturbed individual rather than the cause of it. So I apologize to all the mothers out there whom I may have tarred with a naive brush. chalk it up to my own youth and that of my chosen profession.
You're on the couch again with Dr. Dave. And shrink wrap radio is playing on again.
Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head.
Speaking of all in your head, it wasn't necessarily all in your head if you had trouble downloading or listening to Shrink Wrap Radio earlier this week. It turns out there was a problem with the pod show servers that host our show. I wasted several hours trying to cure a situation that I thought might be on my end, only to discover that it was an issue I had no control over. This outage affected all the shows on the Podshow network, and it took about 72 hours for them to get restored across the whole system. Later in the week, I was listening to Adam Curry's podcast, and he confessed that the problem was the result of someone in Podshow forgetting to re-register the domain name podshow.com with GoDaddy, where it's hosted. Can you believe that? I'll bet somebody's head rolled on that one. It was probably one of those situations where somebody thought somebody else was supposed to do it. The irony is that all across the network, for months now, we've been promoting GoDaddy. And by the way, this was not GoDaddy's fault that the name didn't get re-registered. So, in addition to telling you that you can register a domain name at GoDaddy for only $6.95 a year if you use the discount code of SHRINK3, I'm also going to suggest that you register it for more than 1 year, or at the very least, program a reminder to yourself to re-register it after the year has passed. Longtime listeners know that I like to welcome the people who've recently signed up on our Frapper map at www.frapper.com/shrinkwrapradio. And I commented that we had more pins on the map, but the Frapper interface has changed, and I couldn't tell who had joined or where they were. Well, I'm happy to report that I actually heard back from someone at Frapper who told me how to get that info back. You have to select the View All Pins button, and then it shows the list of names and places. So I've got a long list of people I want to welcome into our community and thank for putting themselves on our map. So here's a big shout out to Karen in Olathe, Kansas, to Shay in Edmonton, Canada, Brad, Denton, Texas, Bonnie in Athens, Georgia, Andy in Gateshead, England, Thomas in Mobile, Alabama, Bridgehands, Petaluma, California, that's right close to me, Jack in Bozeman, Montana, Gary in Owensburg, Kentucky, Paul in Upland, California, Vanessa in Boston, Mass, Chris in Wimbledon, England, Thomas in Oslo, Norway, Meta, but I don't, it's got the street address, but I can't read the city, Fernando in Mexico City. I think you might be the first person south of the border. I've been waiting so long to get somebody from Mexico, Central, or South America. Gita in Pasadena, Paul in Sydney, Australia, Ataur in Islamabad, Pakistan, Brandy in Danville, Ryan in Greeley, Colorado, On in Las Vegas, Carl in Rutland, Vermont, Tom in Melbourne, Australia, Wendy in Winterville, North Carolina, Stacy in Pasadena, California, Stefan in Innsbruck, Austria, Alexander in Moscow, Russia. That is a first. So happy to hear from you, Alexander, and hope you'll drop me a line and tell me something about yourself. You also put a photo of yourself there, which I really appreciated. Pan Pan in Shanghai, China. I think that might be our first one in Asia. And Joss in Den Haag, South Holland, I believe. Martha in Montreal, Canada. So welcome to all of you. And if you are not yet on our Frapper map, it just takes a moment to put yourself there. You'll find a link on our website at shrinkwrapradio.com. And at the end of the year, I'll randomly draw a person from the Frapper map to send a copy of my book to, in which I psychologically profile an infamous serial killer.
I'm Jack Ward from the Sonic Society podcast, and you're on the couch with Shrink Wrap Radio. Dr. Dave will be back in a moment.
And here I am already. We received a lot of listener email, and I want to acknowledge several from David McCartney, who's a web designer, and who alerted me to the fact that the show's page at shrinkwrapradio.com has been taking a long time to load. I took his advice and shortened the time by reducing the amount of resolution on all the photos on that page and by breaking up the list of 53 episodes to this point, this one being number 54, so that they're on three pages instead of all being on one page. I hope this will be a positive benefit for any of you who've experienced something similar. Thanks again for the heads up, David. I received several emails about our last show on Tibetan Buddhism. By and large, they give additional support to my contention that Buddhism has a valid claim as an approach to psychology and that there's an increasing agreement or overlap between current thinking and cognitive therapy and that of Buddhist psychology. For example, listener Carl G. writes, "Hello, Dr. Van Nuys. I recently listened to your podcast on Tibetan Buddhist psychology. Buddhist psychology in general is something I've begun to study and is the psychological theory that my coursework in psychology is based on. I just wanted to let you know that I thought the interview was interesting and am now searching for the movie that you talk about. I also wanted to say that Buddhism is less a religion and more a practice and that psychology is at its core. Many of the behavioral modification techniques that have been discovered over the last several decades by Western psychologists were in use for Buddhist monks in training their minds for the past couple thousand years. In fact, one of the main sections of Buddhist canon, the Abhidharma, deals solely with psychology. The growing field of contemplative psychotherapy is entirely based on Asian and Buddhist psychology." Good point, Carl. And Carl also included a link to a very fine paper he wrote for school on the subject. Carl's note concludes, "Thanks for a great podcast. Both myself and my girlfriend, who's a Master of Science candidate in clinical psychology, enjoy it a great deal." So thanks very much for that very insightful note. And then Brian S. in Sydney, Australia, writes in a similar vein, "Dear Dr. Dave, thank you for your excellent interview on Buddhist psychology. I was interested in your remarks about Buddhism, explaining your rationale for including a Buddhist interview in your podcast. Interestingly, the Dalai Lama has compared Buddhism to cognitive psychology in a series of interviews conducted with Howard Cutler, MD. And that's in a book called The Art of Happiness, A Handbook for Living, Holder and Stoughton, 1998. Well, thanks for calling that to my attention, Brian. I did not know that the Dalai Lama had made that comparison. In his note to me, Brian quotes Dr. Cutler as saying, "As a psychiatrist, I was struck by the parallels between analytic meditation and modern cognitive therapy." So, Brian, thanks for sharing that quote. I had never heard anyone else make the comparison to cognitive therapy that I've been making. So it's good to know that there's some support for my insight. Brian goes on to suggest that Dr. Cutler might make a good guest. So, Brian, thanks for that suggestion, and I'll keep it in mind. And then just today, I received this cute comment in response to the show on Tibetan Buddhism. Doug in Massachusetts writes, "What did you use for your mobile sound? It sounded great. I was listening while I was driving, trying to meditate on the concept that this is all an illusion, not a good idea. I'll try that again when the other illusion can't drive into me." Thanks, Doug. I got a nice chuckle out of that. I can't resolve the paradox of driving and illusion for you, but I can tell you that I recorded the interview on an Etoral R09 digital recorder using two Griffin lapel mics. While I'm at it, I also want to acknowledge several very helpful emails from Stu W. in Florida, alerting me to the difficulty I referred to earlier about people not being able to download episodes. He actually discovered a workaround which seemed to solve the problem, but later I learned the problem was really with Podshow and not the URLs I had provided. Nevertheless, Stu, thanks for your helpful suggestions. I think for today I'll only cover one more email, and actually it's a voicemail from Pan Pan in Shanghai.
Dear Dr. Dave, I got a question about podcast number 25. The podcast is about NLP. In that interview, the interviewee states why she's such a fan of NLP and how she became such a fan of NLP. She turned into an NLP fan because of the fact that she got rid of her phobia, her letter phobia, during a demo session and demo NLP session of a teacher. She states that she cannot totally clearly remember what went on because she was under a light trance or in a light trance. Now, from what I understood is that NLP therapy has nothing to do with hypnotherapy. So my question is, did the demo NLP teacher put her under in a hypnosis, or what happened there? Because that's what I like to know. Many thanks beforehand. Keep the podcasting going on.
Hey, Pan Pan, thanks for that question. First of all, I have to say I'm always gratified when new listeners discover Shrink Wrap Radio and go back to listen to the old shows. None of them are really time-dated. I think previously you mentioned that you use Podshow to listen to Shrink Wrap Radio. That's great, but if you want to hear the early shows, you'll have to go to shrinkwrapradio.com or to iTunes. In terms of your question, actually you are mistaken in your impression that NLP has nothing to do with hypnotherapy. In fact, if you listen to episode number 50 with Bill O'Hanlon, you'll learn that NLP, or neuro-linguistic programming, evolved out of an attempt to model the work of a very famous hypnotherapist, Milton Erickson. Yes, Patty McCormick, the person on my show who you refer to, was probably in a light trance or state of suggestibility. Milton Erickson repeatedly demonstrated, as have others, that it's possible to induce such a state without a formal hypnotic induction. Okay, I think that'll wrap it up for today. Remember, you can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. And you can leave voicemails on Skype. Our name there is ShrinkPod. And you can use MyChingo on our website as another way of leaving your voice messages. Thanks again to my guest, Dr. Lorna Catford, for the interview. Our next show will feature Daniel Amen, MD, talking about his book, Change Your Brain, Change Your Life. I've already conducted the interview, and I don't mind telling you it's a good one. We close with a piece of PodSafe music which seems particularly appropriate given my confession of the bad rap psychology has sometimes given mothers. Hopefully this will make some amends. It's called Mother, and it's performed by Kevin Reeves. You'll find a link to this tune in our show notes at shrinkwrapradio.com. That's it for now. This is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
I've been down, I've been out, and I've felt like my life's caving in, and I can't seem to find what life's about, and I've lost my direction again. Of the day, I know that my solace is a
here I go,
here I go.
Trying to make it in a town that can wound and betray.
But I know.
Feeling nice.